Still Not Asking For It, a podcast brought to you by Hope Harbor, a sexual trauma recovery center. I am your host, Elena, and today we have Hope Harbor's prevention specialist, Maya, to talk about the history of rape in the American South. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yes. Maya, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So my name is Maya Antonich, and I'm a prevention specialist at Hope Harbor, and I've been working with the agency since October, but I've been involved for a couple of years now in a role of a volunteer. I was an emergency advocate for a couple of years. And what I do is I implement prevention-based programs in middle schools and high schools in our 10-county area. And those programs are designed to help eradicate power-based personal violence within our communities.
So today we had planned to kind of talk about some of the research that you'd been doing that kind of originated out of a conversation about a volunteer training, a volunteer meeting, about like the history of the anti-rape movement. And then you kind of looked a little bit further back than that. And so go ahead and tell us, yeah, like what you've been reading, what you've been researching, and kind of why we're doing this today.
In my research, I focused on legal definitions of rape and sexual assault, particularly in the 18th and 19th century and early 20th century. And I mostly focused on Southern horrors by a scholar, Estelle Faisner, and Redefining Rape, a book written by Estelle Friedman. But the reason why I think it's important for this to be our first episode and to discuss historical underpinnings of anti-rape campaigns is because I think in general, talking about past helps us highlight the accomplishments and progress that anti-rape advocates and organizations like ours had achieved in the fight against sexual violence. It ultimately shows us how far we've come and how far we can go as an agency, but also as a community. And ultimately, I think talking about history, it could help us improve in order to become a violence-free society in general. But specifically, why I think it's important to talk about this at the time in history that we find ourselves in is I think it's important to point out struggles of those who came before us and give them credit when it's due. Ultimately, we live at the time when national reckoning is taking place, right? We just had a centennial anniversary for women's suffrage, and public reception has been mixed, which that hasn't been the case in the past. And we have to think in nuanced ways in order to truly understand the struggle of all American people, not just lauding the dominant narrative. And although this anniversary marks an important achievement in women's history in the United States, I think it's important to understand that many individuals were still left out from voting based on their race. For an example, Black women still had to contend with paying poll taxes, literacy examinations, along with experiencing economic disadvantages. So thinking about historical process in complex ways can help us move forward by becoming more inclusive and more tolerant and more open to what is to come.
Right. I feel like it's important to point out and probably helpful, although maybe it was a bit obvious, that you are a historian. Would you use that label since you have a master's in history?
Yeah. So I finally utilized my degree in history.
Yay!
But yes, I'm definitely passionate about history. And I also teach an introductory course at Western. So I've been doing a research by exploring the relation between gender and citizenship for some time. So I found this topic to be really interesting because ultimately when we talk about history of sexual violence, it is impossible to separate it from the larger fight for political inclusion, particularly in the American context. So anti-rape campaigns go hand in hand with the expansion of political and social rights.
So basically, you know what you're talking about.
Sure.
and I do, I find this like topic one, I mean, super interesting, but also really important to point out, because I think for many folks, they would say the Me Too movement would be, you know, the anti-rape movement, right? Or like on the surface level, looking into the history of the anti-rape movement and the work that so many survivors have put to where, you know, to get us to where we are today, came from like the 60s. Like we, like that's really easy to find on the internet, is like how this came from the civil rights movement and really the work of Black women. And so whenever we started having these discussions, I found it, yeah, so interesting. I mean, for me, right, like I'm learning as well that this started way earlier. So what time period are we talking about?
So yes, generally when we talk about anti-rape movements and anti-rape campaigns, we think of the feminist beginnings, right, or the second wave feminism. However, we also have to think about rape in historical terms, and for that we have to go way back. So during the pre-colonial era, before the European arrival, the rape took place, but it wasn't on a major scale in the native communities. It was usually reserved for a warfare tactic. So for an example, an opposing tribe would generally kidnap women, but then they would take them in as wives or concubines. Well, in contrast, when Europeans came, native women were treated as sexually available objects, and ultimately after they're assaulted, they would be left or, you know, discarded, right? Unlike in the native societies. And when the rape would occur within the native societies, the survivors had the opportunity to choose the punishment for the perpetrator. But obviously that changed when the colonizers came here. And I think it's important to know that rape as a capital offense was taken seriously since the 13th century in the British law. You know, in theory, that, you know, British law established rape as a capital offense, and this law was adopted in the colonies. But nevertheless, the prosecutions and actually the enforcement of that legal accountability does not really match the assertions that rape was taken seriously, if that makes sense.
Right. So you said that the survivors would often get to decide how to deal with the perpetrators. You mean like the whole town or community wouldn't like come up and be like, but what was she wearing? Are you sure?
Well, it was in a tribal setting, right? So that the decision making, obviously they had the chieftains in certain communities, but it would be, you know, they would allow the survivor to, or as a community, they would come up with a decision how to deal with the a person who assaulted someone else.
Oh,
so it wasn't terms and, you know, yeah, what was she wearing? But it was more of a communal decision, which it's in contrast with how the, you know, European legal system works.
Right, which is, I mean, like restorative justice or like a transformative justice type of approach, that community accountability, the survivor has a say in what happens, which we know,
well,
right,
yeah,
originated from, yeah, tribal communities, small indigenous groups.
But even the healing through intergenerational trauma actually stems from the ideas from the native societies.
Yeah, to be discussed on another episode, because that's a whole that's a whole topic, right? Like it's a whole 45 minutes at least within itself.
So once we come to the revolutionary era, what occurs is the expansion of rights for white property owning males. And ultimately, their rights and protection expand while others contract, right?
Which is the nice way to say that white men came in and ruined everything.
Pretty much. But then it's during the antebellum era, which is the enslavement era, right? Race began to define rape, particularly in the South. And the way that a rave was perceived, or what that, sorry.
You're good. But I think this is really important so we can point out, right, like we're located in Kentucky, you know, that you cannot separate, right, this history. I mean, I don't think anyone in America, right, can like really separate, you know, from this, but especially when like it's not uncommon for us in the South and in Kentucky, although Mel, our producer's from Louisville, and they like to think that they're different than the rest, than us Southern Kentuckians.
Louisville is not the South.
But
even though it doesn't show very much right now.
Right. But it's not uncommon for us to see a rebel flag, to see multiple rebel flags in one day, maybe. I mean, it still stands out. But this was something that I really appreciated, Maya, that you had pointed out in your research, which you had mentioned the text, Southern Horrors. That like this is specific to the South, right? Like that we need to discuss what rape and sexual violence looked like in the South. So I found that really cool. So go ahead, continue. Antebellum South, which we now know, right, means Civil War. Antebellum does not mean anything else.
Well, antebellum is pre-Civil War times, but okay.
Yeah. Thank you for that distinction.
But the reason why we're specifically looking into the South, obviously we live in the South, right? And I think we have to look at the historical processes here where we live to understand why are some symbols from the Civil War era, why were they normalized in our context? And why certain, you know, depictions of particularly Black males as rapists, and we also have to kind of understand how that came along. But particularly in the, you know, during the antebellum South, the race began to define rape. For one, Black women could not be raped because they were enslaved, right? So they were treated like property. And then Black men kind of threatened the white female virtue. So on the one hand, right, there's sexually available enslaved Black women. And then on the other hand, there's like this idea that we need to protect white womanhood.
That notion too carries on with the imagery of Black women, right? Like, I mean, that we still even see and like hear discussed today, that Black women are viewed as hypersexualized, that they couldn't possibly not want it, right? Which is still a very damaging and present symbol and stereotype.
What I also wanted to include, while race was defining rape and definitions of rape, ultimately class played an important role. So elite white Southern women were perceived as the epitome of womanhood, right? And in, for an example, poor white women carried the burden of proof if they accused their perpetrators of rape. So for elite Southern women, it was enough that they make an accusation, while it was also difficult for them to even get to that point. But nevertheless, particularly for poor white Southern women, it was difficult because they had to prove force and lack of consent by proving that they had a good reputation prior to the assault, or they had to provide evidence that, you know, she had disclosed the assault to a third party right after it happened. They, you know, she had to prove physical injury, and then there had to be a proof of actual resistance. So although race was, you know, the most important category that kind of impacted definitions of rape, ultimately class also played a role in antebellum South. But then in post-Reconstruction era, or even during Reconstruction era, it becomes even more so racialized.
Yes. So I want to get back to the class issue, because that's definitely an identity in an area where it often gets, it's not pointed out, right? Like we're not in a lot of issues, but I think especially when it comes to sexual violence, the barriers that poor folks have that intersects, right, with that race, and it becomes different. But I was curious if in your research, it talked about what was done to impose this presentation of Black men being dangerous to white women, or if it discussed what those efforts were made by, or like how that was spread, how that idea was spread that Black men were dangerous.
Right. Again, it was a process, right? It didn't happen overnight, but it's related to the political rights that Black men were gaining, particularly after the emancipation. So white Southern women also sought to expand their protection. So we have to understand that when we talk about rights, they were more so thought of as protections, right? So now we have Black males being emancipated. At the same time, in a post-Civil War era, we have white women wanting more protections because of the traumatic experiences they underwent during the war, right? Often the Confederate soldiers would leave or run away once the Union soldiers were, moving along, and they were left alone. And sometimes they would become, right, the slaveholders themselves, or they would take care of the plantations. But what's interesting that during the Civil War era, there's not much mentioning that Black males were a threat to white Southern women. Actually, more often than not, they felt protected because they were, men with them. What they perceived as a bigger threat was Union soldiers who were coming. And while Civil War in general is considered as quote unquote low rape war, nevertheless, rapes were happening even by the Union soldiers. But they would generally rape Black women at presence of white Southern women. So I thought that was really an interesting dynamic. So white Southern women would be watching this, and then in post-Civil War era, it somehow became like, oh, now Black males are a threat.
So are you saying that because of the rights and the protections that were rising for Black men, that basically this message or this idea that they were dangerous to white women was kind of spread by people who were upset by those rights, or that it was like an effect of it? Or just talk a little bit more about that.
So in order to protect the white Southern womanhood, right, they turned to their male counterparts for protection, right, for these protections, because still at this time, they weren't really calling for political rights, right? This is late 19th century. We see slowly that happening, but what they wanted is that protection. So then lynching became a tool of, political and social suppression in the name of protection of white womanhood, right? So there's multifold purposes of lynching, but image of a Black man as a rapist emerges basically out of those political anxieties of white men, as they had to contend now with the political power that Black males were gaining, even though in reality, right, they were still suppressed on so many levels. They were discouraged from voting. But also in general, white Southern society at large believed that Black people, without the protections and guidance of white masters, would return to quote unquote African savagery, right? So like that moral component came from, the white society gave that to enslaved people.
So this reminds me of, because I've been, I've watched quite a few documentaries and read these texts about, racial issues historically in America and presently. And the film, which came out in 1915, what time period is that? Is that Reconstruction?
That's more of a progressive era.
That ended in 1877. I see your notes now.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, whatever time period that is. But
say early, that's the World War I period.
Okay, World War I time period, 1915, the birth of a nation, which, at the time, and from what I understand, is still like viewed within film history, like as this like big deal. But the whole story was that, that Black men or specifically a black man raped a, or attempted to rape a white woman. The white woman then dies by suicide and to escape. Instead of being raped, she chooses to die by suicide, like this, you know, dramatic scene. And then it's kind of credited as being like the rebirth of the KKK. I actually, like, in one documentary, it even talked about that this was, I'm getting off topic a little bit, but that it was why the KKK started burning crosses was because it showed that imagery in this film, The Birth of a Nation. So like when you, so like, obviously we're like, right, like pre-TV, pre-film, you know, in these eras that we're discussing, right, the antebellum era, Civil War, you know, but that these messages were still being spread and still being shared.
Yes, and they originate ultimately in post-Civil War era, right, Reconstruction era, and then it carries into the 20th century. But so in this, in Southern Horrors book by Faismer, so what she does, she looks at the intersections of Ida B. Wells and Rebecca Felton, who are both trying to expand women's protections, right? Including pointing out the issues surrounding sexual assault, right? But Felton felt that, you know, she was even quoted saying that being raped by a black male is worse than death, right? So ultimately in, you know, that what you just mentioned in the documentary, these are the ideas kind of slowly tagging onto each other. And then it was even in pre-TV era, because particularly at the beginning of the 20th century, there's a lot of anti-black propaganda, but not only in film, but this was also happening in local newspapers. I mean, local newspapers were one of the major culprits in the spread of lynching propaganda as well. And, you know, novels were being focused now on stereotypes of this black brute who rapes a white woman, right? So these depictions have been going on for a few decades, and then unfortunately, they kept going on even later in the 20th century.
So you referenced the newspapers, you know, the media that was spreading these perceptions, these stereotypes. I don't think they're actually stereotypes. They're just false, right? These ideas that, yeah, black men are dangerous, that black women are hypersexualized, you know, and that carried over into novels, book writing. And when we know who was really in those spaces, right, which were white people, these, you know, ideas were being spread because the systems that they were being spread through were controlled by white people, you know, which we still see, you know, today.
I agree. Yeah. But yeah, so what I wanted to add that even though, right, this myth of a black rapist emerges, and for white women in the South, since we're talking about the South, although, you know, we're specifically talking about the South, but that doesn't mean in the North, these rapes and depictions were not also taking hold, right? What I wanted to actually say, I remember growing up, and this was even in Europe, and watching movies like Gone with the Wind with my grandma, right? And she loves Carla O'Hare, and I think everybody grew up with watching that, right? And it was this idyllic depiction of a white woman, you know, and an idyllic depiction of enslaved individuals, right, living in close proximity to a white Southern woman. But I think that's important to know that, like, all of this was normalized, right, in the, specifically in the 20th century, right? It took a long time to get there. And, you know, Elena mentioned earlier, we see still rebel flags and, you know, all the depictions of, you know, Civil War era, but a lot of it has to do with the, right, early 20th century and how these stereotypes, right, were formulated. But not only that, how the legacy of Civil War was shown in kind of normal terms. And this is where Northerners are complicit, right? This is where, as a nation, we're complicit, because now it's accepted in certain settings or even in certain places to carry a Southern flag or whatnot.
I don't know what this says about me, but I have never seen Gone with the Wind. So honestly, I couldn't even tell you the plot. I should have done more research. My should have let me know you're going to reference that so I could offer something. But I am one of those people though. Like you'll be like, oh, have you seen? But I am one of those people where it's like, oh, have you seen blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, ugh. Like I only recently watched Mary Poppins, but,
But
that's so much more problematic than Gone with the Wind.
I know. Rob's like, she's a witch. Like
Mary Poppins is so good.
Like, how have you not watched it?
Gone with the Wind has a lot of issues that I don't understand how people didn't see as issues because it's so stereotypical of just racial roles.
But again, you're looking from a today, contemporary perspective, right? Like, if you look at our education system here in the U.S., and so I think there was a case in Texas, they're still depicting slavery as a idyllic time frame.
And like as a choice too, maybe?
Well, I mean, it was like kind of, but like it's always depicting like that enslaved people are happy. They have these close relationships with the slaveholders. They're helping raising their children. You know, so it's like this one big happy family, right? And horrors are often under, you know, completely disregarded, right? And now, like when I was watching it from a European perspective, right? Because America is this place of civil rights, like it's this place of progress. So, you know, that problematic history was never highlighted, right? Unless you get into depth, right? So, I mean, even growing up, I know that even when I moved here and when I was seeing rebel flags, I thought I was like, okay, this is weird. But then you slowly start to understand, okay, this is really bad. And again, it's not a switch. It takes time. It's a process. And I think that's why it's important to talk about, you know, how things evolve.
So I hear, knowing the work that we do in this trauma work, trying to prevent sexual violence from happening, trying to spread awareness, trying to knock out all of these, you know, deeply ingrained norms, right, of violence, of victim blaming, of just, misconceptions, that knowing that it's been ingrained in us for hundreds of years, generations and generations, on one end, I'm like, okay, you know, give yourself a break. We're not going to fix this, you know, immediately, you know, one 30-minute talk, you know, with this college group or this community group isn't going to erase, right? Like everything, we're not going to blow everyone's minds like immediately. But then on the other side, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is hopeless. Our country is built on garbage. But I do find it important. I'm glad that you brought it up because I was wanting to bring it up, but I didn't really know how to. About, you growing up in Europe and like that was different. Right? Like you don't come from this, like this lineage, which I personally don't know my ancestry, but like a lot of folks do, especially in the South, and they've come from white people who enslaved Africans. And so that, like, you don't come from that history, and I know we've talked about this before, because like what we do in our work and like talking, especially in the South, right? We're like white people, you know, like saying as if white people, which I recognize, like we're making a generalization, right? Which I, in my head is like, not a problem because white people are oppressors and like we're the problem. And it's a totally okay, you know, to make this generalization, but having conversations with you, you know, as a white person, but coming from Europe, and not coming from slaveholders, that's different. And I like that, I don't know, nuance, that complexity, just that different viewpoint that you have, and that coming, like, and when, you know, you came to the South, that it was like, oh my gosh.
It was definitely a cultural shock. You bring an important point because things are complicated, right? History is complicated. We as individuals are complicated. And it takes a lot to undo a lot of what had happened in the past. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be better. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't strive to be better, that we shouldn't educate yourself to move forward. And yes, I come from a different perspective, and I often, I don't know, like to me, you know, when we say, I come also from a generation that we don't want to be labeled. You know, it was prior to, you know, I was born in the early 80s and stuff. We don't want labels. We don't want anyone putting generalizations or labels on us, right? And now in the era when we have to acknowledge that the multiplicity of identities and people want to be here, you know, heard. Every country, you know, there's a lot of issues, historical issues for every country, mine too. But I think that me coming not only from Europe, but I also come from Eastern Europe. And after all, that's we are not perceived as, and you know, we're not Anglo-Saxons, we're not the Western Europeans, right? We're the quote-unquote cradle of the civilization. We come from the backyard of Europe. So we were also colonized, right, by the Ottoman Empire, by Austria-Hungary, you know, and then we have actually a legacy of anti-fascist movement during and after World War II. So I come from a very, you know, unusual perspective. And then historically in this country, people from Eastern Europe, so Southern Europeans like Italians, right? And not only Southern Europeans, but even Irish were not deemed to be white, right? They were classified as a different or lesser type of white, right? So in this country, there's a history of putting this hierarchy on race. But somehow over the decades during the 20th century, they've become white, right? So even I have that option to become white. So I am, you know, aware of my own privileges, even though, you know, my ancestors or I did not contribute to the creation of this system, but I can see how I have an advantage because of the way I look. And on the one hand, that's really sad because there's so many racialized others who've been, you know, who built this country, and at times there's not still at that point where they're accepted into full citizenship.
Right. I'm really glad that we talked about this. So by no means am I dismissing it. Maybe that's another episode on your whiteness, on Maya's whiteness. But going back, we discussed, you know, like how rape was used, right? Like what rape looked like, you know, and then how it was spread to become a race issue, a class issue. Can we talk about as well, like what it looked like when survivors started kind of stepping up, when those who had been raped or were fearful of being raped, what that looked like and kind of those steps?
So for particularly the role of Black women in anti-rape campaigns, it's important to highlight. And while, you know, there were many notable women who fought for protections and even expansion of rights for Black women, like Sojourner Truth or Harriet Jacobs, and even Ida B. Wells, right? They brought the attention of the abuses under the slavery by white masters, right, against Black women. I think what's also important to highlight in a scholarship, recent scholarship has been good about it, is that there are a lot more of anonymous women, right, who started coming out against their perpetrators. So the Black women's testimonies, particularly after the Civil War and during the Reconstruction era, you know, proved to be an important step for the legal protection under the law for sexual assault. And this is not only for Black women, but women in general, right? So even in the American context, at times we tend to separate the issue of a Black person versus an issue of a white person or a white woman. But at times, this struggle for expansion of rights actually benefited larger population. So Black women were courageously coming out to talk about the suffered sexual abuses under the white men. So on the one hand, we have Black women who are sexually assaulted by white men, but then somehow it was also perceived that rape wasn't really kind of happening, you know, among the Black community, right? So not only did Black women have to contend with white perpetrators, but also Black perpetrators, right? So it's even more so difficult for them to navigate through this. But many women came up, you know, Memphis riots and post, right after the war, right? That also happened when five women came out and actually gave testimonies against their rapists. And then we hear stories, you know, throughout, you know, even the 20th century when women keep coming out and telling their stories, even though, you know, they are met with resistance, right? They're not often heard, and it takes a long time for them to get acknowledged. But nevertheless, like, we need to point out that resilience of Black women and how they actually, you know, continue to fight. And, you know, even like Recy Taylor comes up, and she was an important figure. She was a Black woman who was assaulted and then actually Rosa Parks was an investigator in her case. And it's also important to point out how these Black women ultimately were seeded, they're putting the seed into the civil rights movement, right? When we think of civil rights movement, we often think about Black male figures. It actually started earlier than that. And there's a really good book about it by Danielle McGuire, At the Dark End of the Street. And she examines Recy Taylor's case.
I'm so glad that you brought up Recy Taylor, because I had a note to bring her up, because in the preliminary research that I had done for like uncovering the anti-rape movement and seeing who really was like behind that she's a name that you often can find. And by often, I mean on like two websites where, you know, this type of information, I feel like, you know, is credited to the work of Black women, which I think is, yeah, so important to share, not only within our agency and like our volunteers, but yeah, like share with everyone that we're acknowledging and also wanting to promote that difficult work that was done.
Yeah. And I mean, when we think of, again, of anti-rape movement, and as you mentioned earlier, it's often tied into the 60s movement of civil rights and the second wave feminism. But again, we have to think in long term and what had happened prior to that to get us to that point, right? Nothing happens with the flip of a switch. And, you know, that's why it's important to have these conversations and to acknowledge that it's going to take a long time for us to get to the point where we want to be. And then even then, we're going to be contending with different issues. And I think, especially at this point in time, it's important to come to terms with American history and to kind of, you know, talk about these topics, not only, you know, in terms of sexual violence, but in terms of other types of political rights that, you know, we still haven't resolved for many.
Right. There's still work to be done, plenty of work to be done. Okay, so to wrap things up a bit, what is something that you really want folks to take away from this? Or maybe something that you wanted to share, but we didn't get to it, kind of just short couple sentences. Or maybe something that you found to be really interesting, your biggest takeaway?
I think when we talk about colonization, right, as a process and colonization of mind and not only, you know, but even when we tie it into sexual assault, it's important to decolonize, right, the way we think, and to even decolonize rape, because that becomes a crucial component of redefining our laws to address the effects caused by colonization, including sexual violence for racialized, gendered, and disabled others, right? And this is not to attack white manhood, right? White manhood, but it's to understand that, you know, actions of certain group of people affected others. And a lot of the expansion of rights that happened for white property owning male, right, wasn't the account of the other. And I think now that's generally an accepted historical narrative, right? It's just that sometimes reality doesn't match the scholarship, right? We have to get there somehow at some point where, and the only way to do it is through education. And we need to, kind of improve our education system. But not only that, as individuals, I think it's our responsibility to learn, even though you don't like history, if you don't like history.
I love history because I'm also a humanities major. I don't have a master's, but okay. So I'm really glad, right, that we talked about your personal experience, right, growing up in Eastern Europe, because like I do it all the time and I was going to do it again. And I knew that I shouldn't because you'd pointed out like not all white men, not all white people have that same historical role, even though they are afforded some of those privileges. But I still think this is a safe place to say that white men have been trash and could continue to be trash.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's not the point that I was trying to make. My point was that it's more complicated than
I know.
Making that statement. But, and again, white men without property did not have, you know, especially, you know, in the antebellum era, did not have the same rights. They couldn't even vote. So what type of like, so that this is when we have to talk about, you know, intersection of class, right, and race. And, you know, when we talk about class, we often think about, oh, poor people, disadvantaged people. But then we also have to think about the elites, right? How does wealth contribute to somebody's privilege? And then if they belong to another, you know, to a certain race and stuff, how does that, where does that put them?
Right.
You know, so.
And pointing out too, education is a huge component of it because, yeah, and decolonize everything. But that we can only move forward. We can only like, or else we're like, we're going to continue in a circle almost, right? Like, unless we really address, you know, our role and our history. I think this is relevant, you know, I mean, especially for those of us who are doing this work, you know, within rape crisis centers and anti-sexual violence. But I think for anyone who recognizes that this is an issue and that we need to address it, yeah, understand that history, be educated about it so that we can start fixing it, addressing it in multiple different ways. And recognizing, yeah, those systems of barrier and that class is still a barrier for a lot of people. You know, we see that all the time of believability, of access to resources. And then for folks who, yeah, if they're not thought to be believed, they're not even going to come forward in the first place, much less be able to navigate the system on their own. And so I think this was great. Do you feel like we got everything?
Yeah. And I guess the only thing that I want to mention, you know, when we talk about legal definition of rape is that we went from, we talked about a black male being a rapist of a generally white woman, right? And so there was this idea that it's a stranger. And then only in the 20th century do we actually get a legal recognition that an intimate partner can also be abusive and can also sexually assault someone. So again, by looking at these processes and how we evolve, right, this is how we got to the point where we are right now.
Yeah, that stranger rape, while it does happen, happens at much lower rates than intimate partner or acquaintance rape is the terminology we use. But also like sexual assault crossing racial lines is pretty rare as well. Much more likely for the perpetrator and the victim to be the same race, which is really interesting. I don't have any other statistic or information about that, like why that is, but that is a statistic that I know that I've seen many times.
Yeah. So, I mean, and then if we go back to the creation of these stereotypes that we still, you know, some people still hold in their heads, right, when they think about rape or who tends to be a perpetrator are still pretty, you know, relevant today. And even though the reality reflects something else.
Okay, I'm going to wrap us up because I feel like we will talk about this forever. So I want to say thank you so much, Maya, for joining us today and sharing your knowledge and all of the hours of work you have done for this. I still think it'd be really awesome if you did a blog post about this stuff that folks can check out through our website. We'll probably have information too on our social media about some of the stuff that we've discussed as well, Facebook, Twitter, the Instagram. And if you have any questions or comments for us, our contact is in the info section. I will also list the resources that Maya referenced, the few texts, Southern Horrors, I remember was one of them that she had, so that you all can check it out or try to check it out. I feel like some of it had some scholarly limitations due to her being connected to Western Kentucky University. But definitely check back for more episodes. Follow us so you can stay updated for when we release episodes. And remember, we're still not asking for it.
This podcast has been brought to you by Hope Harbor, a sexual trauma recovery center located in South Central Kentucky. Special thanks to Girl Tones for our intro. Listen to the rest of their song, Can't Pause, and others, wherever you stream or buy music.